about Norway, not only because it's where I've lived for 12 years, but because it's a country that tends to be seen as a model of peace, stability, democracy, and all good things. In the annual United Nations rankings of the best places to live, it usually comes out number one. It also gets top scores for press freedom. I love many things about Norway and the Norwegian people, but the history of the last decade or so tells a story that challenges Norway's international image quite drastically, not least in regard to freedom of expression and the response to Islamic pressure. And it's a story that needs to be told. I moved to Norway in 1999 from Amsterdam, where I had begun my informal education, you might say, about Islam in Europe. In Oslo, I found a situation similar to, if not quite as far along, as that in Amsterdam. In short, largely closed communities of essentially unintegrated Muslims who did not share the values of the society in which they lived, a virtual media silence about this state of affairs, an official policy that Muslims should not be encouraged to embrace so-called Western ideas and values, but rather to preserve their own, and an official pretense that the result of all of this was a wonderful multicultural mosaic that had no downside and that would enrich everyone. Over the years that followed, the silence and the lies began to crumble. The ever-worsening problems began to be discussed with increasing openness. The upstart so-called populist Progress Party, which dared to address these matters honestly, gained support. Researchers reported on how Norwegian Muslim families arranged forced marriages between their children and foreign cousins in order to enable the latter to immigrate to the West, a blatant violation of their children's human rights, as well as a blatant exploitation of Norway's family reunification policies. A few brave souls even began to speak up honestly about the ticklish aspects of Islamic theology. And the nation's multicultural elite was not happy with any of this. Briefly put, that elite fought back using harsh new legislation, using poisonous and demonizing rhetoric about their opponents, and using outright bullying attempts to intimidate and silence speech that questioned and challenged the ideology of multiculturalism, the failures of immigration policy, and the more problematic aspects of Islam. With your indulgence, I'll focus on four episodes that illustrate this situation. Episode number one. On April 19th, 2005, with minimal publicity and with virtually no public discussion, the Norwegian Parliament passed the so-called discrimination law. It was proposed by the Conservative Party, which in Norway is not really all that conservative by American standards, and was supported by every party except the Progress Party. It forbids discrimination and harassment, quote, on the basis of ethnicity, national origin, tribal background, skin color, language, religion, or philosophy of life. And it defines harassment as, quote, actions, omissions, or utterances, yes, utterances, that have the effect or are intended to have the effect of being offensive, frightening, hostile, degrading, or humiliating. The law does away with the concept of innocent until proven guilty. If there are circumstances that give reason to believe that a violation of these provisions has taken place, reads the law, it will be assumed that a violation has taken place, unless the person responsible for the action, omission, or utterance can substantiate that such a violation has not taken place. In other words, the burden of proof is on the accused. You are guilty until proven innocent. What about punishment? Violating the discrimination law is punishable by fine, but if you violate it jointly with at least two other people, for example, if you are a writer who has conspired with your editor and publisher, you can be jailed for up to 3 years. In short, the law, which was supposedly designed to prevent harassment, is a formula for harassment, harassment of Norwegians who dare to voice uncomfortable truths. Are there discriminatory actions and utterances in Norway today? Yes. In many Oslo homes, women and girls are brutally oppressed, beaten, and raped by men who think it's their sacred right and duty to do so. In mosques, imams spread grotesque lies about Christians, Jews, ethnic Europeans, and gays. But it's precisely for these kinds of actions at utterances that the discrimination law calls out an exception. I quote, "The law applies to all areas of society with the exception of family life and personal relationships, and to actions and activities performed under the auspices of religious communities and enterprises with a religious or life philosophical purpose," close quote. In other words, it's permissible for an imam to preach that Norwegians are swine, but if a Norwegian answers back, he risks prison. In the same way, a Muslim woman or girl can live as a prisoner in her home, but a Norwegian human rights activist who tries to address this problem risks being found guilty under the law. In Norway, important proposals for legislation are usually debated ad nauseum in the media before the law is actually passed. Not so with the discrimination law. Politicians and journalists strictly avoided talking about it beforehand. The good news is that no one has yet dared to prosecute anyone under the discrimination law. The bad news is that it remains on the books, and as we shall see, there is good reason for concern these days. In fact, more reason than ever, that it may yet be used to target freedom of speech about Islam. Episode 2. You all remember the Danish cartoons. On January 9, 2006, while the newspaper Jyllands-Posten was under siege in Denmark, Vebjørn Selbæk, the editor of a small Christian newspaper called Magasinet in Norway, ran a six-page feature in which he reproduced the Jyllands-Posten page containing the Muhammad cartoons. Selbæk wasn't the only Norwegian editor to reprint the cartoons. Several major papers did. But it was the tiny Magasinet that became the target of politically correct wrath. When Selbæk went on a TV news discussion program to defend his action, his fellow panelists called him a right-wing extremist and accused him of malice toward Islam. Magasinet, a professor complained, was destroying the intercultural harmony that he and others had spent years working for. It didn't seem to occur to him that if printing a few cartoons could destroy this harmony, there may not have been that much harmony there to begin with. Muslim leaders used Selbæk's action as an excuse to target Norway. Norwegian flags were burned, Norwegian businesses boycotted, the Norwegian embassy in Damascus torched. Yet while Denmark's leaders remained resolute in the face of anti-Danish attacks in the Middle East, Norwegian officials caved instantly. Prime Minister Jens Stoltenberg said flat out that Selbæk had been wrong to reprint the cartoons and implicitly threatened Magasinet with prosecution. Not under the discrimination law, curiously, but under Norway's long-dormant blasphemy law, whose repeal Stoltenberg had himself strongly advocated before the cartoon crisis. Norwegian groups charged with defending free speech did not cover themselves in glory either. Throughout the cartoon crisis, the Norwegian Authors Union and Norwegian Freedom of Expression Foundation remained silent. The head of Norwegian Pen called on Selbæk to apologize. An editorial in Teknisk Ukeblad, Technical Weekly, actually suggested that Norwegian companies that were experiencing problems in Pakistan, quote, could demand economic redress from Selbæk to cover their losses. Selbæk's most outspoken critic, Foreign Affairs Minister Jonas Gahr Støre, insisted that freedom of expression, quote, demands in our time and society a sensitivity to ethnic and religious values that mean a lot to people. Goth's daughter, even blamed Selbeck in part for the burning of that embassy in Syria. The rapidity with which he and Prime Minister Stoltenberg knuckled under to jihad could only have been read by Muslim radicals as a sign that Norway was indeed spineless. A country so in love with peace, or with its peace-loving and multicultural self-image, that it would sell out the most precious of democratic principles rather than endure any conflict whatsoever. Goth's daughter was so fearful of backlash from Muslim countries that he sent a letter to Norwegian ambassadors instructing them to respond to any criticism of Marcus Inet by expressing regret for its actions and by stating that it was Norway's belief that free speech comes with limits. For weeks, Selbeck defied death threats, abuse by Norway's cultural elite, and demands from around the world that he apologize. Then, suddenly, he gave in. On February 10th, after several days of intense secret negotiation involving Stoltenberg, Goth and Muslim leaders, Selbeck appeared at a government press room. There, standing alongside several cabinet ministers and 14 imams, led by Muhammad Hamdan, head of Norway's Islamic Council and brother of a Hamas member of the Lebanese parliament, Selbeck read a statement in which he said, "I apologize deeply for the fact that you, as Muslims, have had your religious feelings hurt by what we have done." The Norwegian government was delighted. Goth's daughter congratulated Selbeck on his capitulation, which he characterized grotesquely as an act of responsibility that displayed integrity and courage. In fact, on that day, as Selbeck himself later admitted, quote, "Norway went a long way toward allowing freedom of speech to become the Islamist's hostage." As if Norway hadn't already been disgraced enough, an official delegation led by the Dean of the Oslo Cathedral then traveled to Qatar to meet with the influential Muslim theologian Yusuf al-Qaradawi, a defender of suicide bombers and the author of an essay entitled "Our War with the Jews is in the Name of Islam," and implored him to accept Selbeck's apology. He did. In a 2006 statement reacting to Selbeck's memoir of the Marcus Inet case, Goth's daughter expressed the belief that he and Selbeck could, quote, "agree on the necessity of safeguarding the basic principles on which our society is built, such as freedom of expression and human rights, including the right to practice one's religion freely and the right for one's faith not to be insulted," close quote. To assert that last named right, of course, a right that is radically at odds with the spirit of the Enlightenment, is of course to utterly abrogate freedom of expression. Example, episode 3. On February 29th, 2008, Dag Solstad, one of Norway's most respected novelists, gave a major speech which was heavily covered in the media, entitled "On Freedom of Speech." In Norway, speeches by writers are actually big news. Solstad's message, which came in reaction to the increasingly open discussion of Islam and immigration in Norway, and specifically to the Muhammad cartoons, but was that he was, and I quote, "totally indifferent to freedom of speech," and that he could not, quote, "imagine a future in which a situation arose in which my right to express myself was taken away from me." Throughout his speech, he referred sarcastically to, quote, "the holy idea of freedom of speech," which he described as a, quote, "moral weapon used by the world's richest countries to legitimize their invasion and oppression of poor countries and cultures." Solstad made the argument that, after all, his library is full of books, some of them ancient classics that had survived centuries of societies with censorship, yet here they are on his shelves. So what's to worry about? As he put it, the books survive censorship or no censorship. Besides, you argue, free speech is undesirable anyway since it drowns meritorious works, such as his novels, presumably, in a sea of vulgarity, a category to which he relegated the Muhammad cartoons. This is, let me repeat, one of Norway's most respected writers and intellectuals, who was recently, by the way, granted a generous, tax-free government stipend, which he will receive every year for the rest of his life. What was alarming was not just Sørensen's speech. It was the readiness with which other members of Norway's cultural elite seconded his sentiments. Andreas Skartveit, former director general of the Norwegian Broadcasting Corporation and chairman of a major publishing house, complained in an op-ed that we've made free speech holy and are clinging to this new religion, as he put it, in an unhealthy way. Skartveit argued for what he plainly saw as a more historically sophisticated view. The world is changing, he insisted. It always has been. Sacred things come and go. Once it was the kings who fought for our faith, as the Swedish Gustavus Adolphus, the Lion of the North, fought for Protestantism. Now it is prime ministers, such as Denmark's Fogh Rasmussen, today's Lion of the North, he wrote sarcastically, of course, who fight for our new faith, freedom of expression. Fourth and last and most disturbing example. On July 22nd of this year, a man named Amish Bering Breivik set off an explosion in downtown Oslo that killed several people, then made his way to a nearby island where he gunned down several dozen more people, mostly teenagers. The teenagers were members of the Labour Party's youth group and were attending an annual summer camp at which they hold rallies, give speeches, listen to speeches by party leaders, and so forth. Breivik targeted the island because he was opposed to the Islamization of Norway and held the Labour Party largely responsible for the multicultural ideology that had made this Islamization possible. The massacre shook Norway to its roots. The outpouring of public grief was overwhelming. But even as the majority of the populace was in grief, the cultural elite was at work exploiting the massacre to the hilt. For you see, over the last decade, despite the Discrimination Act, despite the crushing of Vedran Selbekk, and despite the best efforts of people like Dag Solstad, the public discussion of Islam and immigration in Norway had grown ever more open. A decade or so ago, the cultural elite exercised pretty firm control over public discussion of these matters. No more. They had lost control, and they knew it. In recent months, Angela Merkel, Nicolas Sarkozy, and David Cameron had all declared multiculturalism a failure. Last year, a government commissioned report identified by name me and others who have written about Islam as Islamophobes. The point was clearly to shut us up, but it didn't work. Norway's cultural elite was in a jam. Then along came Breivik, and he handed them an opportunity that they were quick to exploit. For Breivik was a terrorist with a difference. He was not a Muslim, but an anti-Muslim. He hated multiculturalism. He despised the Labour Party. Within hours of his capture, the cultural elite's line began to take shape. The lesson of these murders, they said, was that criticism of Islam, immigration, and multiculturalism had gone too far. The Norwegian people owed it to their new Muslim countrymen to embrace them and their religion without qualification. In the days after July 22nd, top Norwegian politicians and the Crown Prince attended services in mosques and made a point of displaying their solidarity with the imams. That wasn't all. Norwegians were not just encouraged to embrace Islam. They were also encouraged to despise Islam's critics. In a rainstorm of op-eds and TV interviews, members of the cultural elite sent out the word that the writers and the Progress Party politicians who had criticized Islam and multiculturalism had shaped the thinking of the mass murderer. They were co-conspirators. They had blood on their hands. They owed it to the Norwegian people to recant and reform. This was a new orthodoxy. And every day, in the weeks after the massacre, it was reinforced in yet another wave of op-eds by and interviews with leading members of the Norwegian political, intellectual, cultural, and media establishment. One of those op-eds was headlined, quote, "We can't ignore the ideological mudbath from which this murderer emerged." Another was entitled, quote, "To you who nourished the killer." On July 28th, the New York Times ran an op-ed entitled "A Blogosphere of Bigots" by two men who are very famous in Norway, novelist Jostein Gaarder and Professor Thomas Hylland Eriksen. "The hatred and contempt from which Breivik drew his deranged determination," they wrote, "were shared with many others throughout the international right-wing blogosphere," close quote. The first writer they named as an example of this execrable phenomenon was me. "I was part of a new right in Europe," they said, "that has, quote, swapped anti-Semitism for Islamophobia. Traditional racism may actually be waning in several European countries, but hostility toward Islam and animosity toward Muslim immigrants and their children is on the rise." I might mention that Jostein Gaarder, co-author of this op-ed, is the same man who wrote a breathtakingly anti-Semitic op-ed several years ago that Norwegian Jewish author Mona Levin described as, quote, "the ugliest thing I have read since Mein Kampf." These were the kind of people who were rushing to attack critics of Islam. Then there was Lars Gule, former head of Norway's Humanist Society. "We need to do something about Breivik's heroes," he wrote ominously. Quote, "It is obvious that certain groups, persons, and communities have contributed to Breivik's warped view of reality, and these people need to take a good look at themselves. If not, others must help them." Who is Gule? In 1977, in his early 20s, he joined the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, a terrorist group responsible for the 1974 Meilat massacre, in which over 100 Israeli children were taken hostage and 22 of them killed. Gule was delegated to set off a bomb in Israel on the 10th anniversary of the Six-Day War, but was stopped at the Beirut airport and imprisoned. Since his release, he has enjoyed a very glittering career at the very top levels of the Norwegian cultural elite. It did not take long for Norway's cultural elite to rally around a new label for their enemies. We were the, quote, "Eurabia writers," the Eurabia propagandists. One of the first to employ this label was Sindre Bongstad, a social anthropologist at the University of Oslo, who went after the Progress Party's former head, Carl I. Hagen. I quote, "We don't know when Carl I. Hagen began to read the type of Eurabia literature that Anders Behring Breivik has also read, but it is well documented that he and several of his fellow party members have read precisely that type of literature," close quote. It was now apparently an offense in Norway simply to have read certain books that the country's new public enemy number one had also read. By the same logic, in fact, by far better logic, one would expect that after 9/11, Madrid, London, Beslan, Bali, Mumbai, and so forth, it would be forbidden to read the Quran. Perhaps the definitive post-July 22nd article came on August 22nd in the form of an often-posted op-ed co-authored by four people, Sindre Bongstad, Thomas Hylland Eriksen, a philosophy professor named Arne Johan Vetlesen, and a young woman named Bushra Ishak, who is a board member of the Anti-Racist Center and the former head of the Muslim Student Association. The op-ed, entitled "Hateful Utterances," was an outright demand for tighter limits on free speech in the wake of July 22nd. "Certain hateful utterances," the four co-authors insisted, "are legally and morally unacceptable. Neither freedom of speech nor the right to express oneself or absolute in any existing human society. Nor does freedom of speech stand above other rights and compliance with key human rights declarations. Decrying what they called, quote, free speech absolutism, and explicitly rejecting the model of the United States, which they described disdainfully as, quote, the country in the world that goes the furthest in protecting the right to expression, including hateful expression, close quote. The authors noted that the European Human Rights Convention is clear that the exercise of freedom of speech imposes a responsibility upon the person expressing himself. Yet in the last decade, they complained, the limits to hateful speech had been stretched very far in Norway. This, they insisted, needed to be reversed in the aftermath of July 22nd, the implication being that Breivik's atrocities were the consequence of other people's exercise of free speech. In the coming years, the op-ed argued, quote, Norwegian editors as well as politicians need to make it clear that it is not a human right to express oneself in public, and that certain hateful utterances are not acceptable. There are others who are quick to agree, including anthropologist Rena Dovin, who cited as an example of what he called conspiracy theories of Islam critics, an op-ed which my friend Hege Storhaug reported, on a Muslim demonstration at which a speaker had called for a new 9/11 in Norway. In Dovin's view, Hege was not reporting in his op-ed on hatred. No, she was expressing a hatred that needs to be quashed. Dovin admitted readily that his own view was, as he himself put it, authoritarian. It should simply not be allowed, he said, to express certain ideas. And he added that he was, and I quote, entirely in favor of what many people are now describing as a witch hunt, for, quote, there needs to be an investigation of what was written before July 22nd and see the connections between words and actions. It was stunning how effective the cultural elite's new line was in the wake of the massacre. Many of those who had criticized Islam and immigration rushed into print to declare their contrition. When a public debate on immigration took place a few weeks after the massacre, it was clear that a new restraint had asserted itself. The subject of Islam was not even mentioned. Self-censorship was the order of the day. The multicultural establishment, in short, had regained the upper hand. Islam had been washed clean in the blood of Breivik's victims. Everything that was true about Islam and about Norwegian immigration policy and about the follies of multiculturalism on the day before the massacres is still true now. But it is more dangerous than ever to say so. At present, in short, free speech in Norway is more imperiled than it has been in a very long time. And where this may lead is not very pleasant to contemplate. Thank you.
Paul. We'll hear from Paul Diamond.
Hello, thank you. Can I just thank what an honor and pleasure it is to be in the United States. I always enjoy coming to your great country. I want to thank the Federalist Society, Paul Marshall and Nina Shea for the honor of being here. I think Bruce has taken a lot of my wind because I wasn't going to go into a great detailed analysis of the legal situation, but I was going to give 6 examples, so at least I'm more than Bruce. And so the Brits can win this one. What I would like to say, though, I'm just going to do is, really, by giving these examples, I just want to show the culture in which we operate in, and I operate in as a practicing barrister, and the environment you work in, of course, is different, but it's a complex situation in the United Kingdom, and I think it's where ground zero is, as the Americans would call it. We've come a long way But before I just start, I want to just make this comment about the use of hate speech, and probably the only legal comment I'm going to make. We do actually have a Religious Hatred Act, but it's which is a sort of effectively a hate speech act, but it's never used. The mechanisms used by the authority are public order acts, which date from 1936. And the issue was subsequently aggravated offences were added to basic assault categories. Now, the reason I actually say that is, of course, that's the United States approach to have general assault categories and then have aggravated categories on racial grounds and so forth. So our tactic, our approach in our similar systems are very similar. Now, we've obviously come a long way since 1991 and the Satanic Verses and the Fatwa against Salman Rushdie. In those days, our then Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher immediately broke off relations with Iran. So that book was published and it was defended ferociously by the government of the day. And people may well wonder whether that would happen in modern Britain. The environment we operate in is the Archbishop of Canterbury has called the introduction of Sharia law inevitable. That was in 2008. I was actually at that talk. He said it in a provocative manner. That was shortly followed by the Lord Chief Justice calling, that's Lord Phillips, calling for the introduction of Sharia law in the United Kingdom. And then that was followed again by our national government giving great impetus and emphasis to Muslim arbitration tribunals, which are now a large number of them are functioning throughout the country, and are going to come in a very unknown fashion. And recently we've had the development of about a dozen areas in the United Kingdom called Sharia-controlled areas, where Islamic radicals have simply put up posters and are enforcing it. No gambling, no music, no prostitution, no drugs, and no alcohol, and are enforcing it. Now, I personally believe there would have been some formal adoption of Sharia law had the Labour Party won the 2010 election in the United Kingdom. That did not take place, as you know. David Cameron became Prime Minister in a coalition. There's been a sea change of attitude by the government. The Ministry of Justice has just sought to conclude a report on the operation of the Muslim arbitration tribunals and how Sharia law is operating in the United Kingdom. The Muslim arbitration tribunals refused to cooperate, just said, we're not telling you what's going on, you find out. And that's, the government found that slightly unsatisfactory and rather surprised at that approach. Baroness Cox, who used to be a backbench peer, has introduced a bill prohibiting Sharia law where there's inequality between men and women. An Islamic preacher called Zakir Naik was refused entry and denied entry into the United Kingdom. Contrast that with numerous Hezbollah spokespeople who were invited in by the previous Labour government. And we had a situation, so although there's been a change, the environment is extremely tough. I say that Sharia law is not going to take place, but the general impetus of what the American First Amendment lawyers would call the establishment of religion by either state disapproval of a religion or state endorsement of religion is actually very real in the United Kingdom. The only problem is the state disapproval is against Christianity and the state endorsement is towards Islam. I was going to just give six examples of the modern environment in the United Kingdom. The first example is the Jerry Springer Show, which was shown on national television by the BBC. The Jerry Springer, the opera, I don't know if you're aware of that. Jesus is a congenital idiot. Jesus wears a nappy. Jesus is slightly homosexual. It caused an uproar when it was shown in Britain. And I think it's important to note, I have differing views on the secularization of Europe, but it caused an uproar when it was shown in Britain. 55,000 complaints were made to the BBC, the largest number of complaints they've ever received. But of course the BBC went ahead and showed it with a flower of self-promotion that we will stand in the face of intimidation. The BBC promotes freedom of speech, and the show went on. It was reviewed internally by the BBC trustees, who called it a work of art. Now, I had, leaving aside the subject matter of it all, Jerry Springer, the opera, a work of art, is even stretching it to most British subjects. We had blasphemy laws at that time in the United Kingdom, and a maverick preacher brought a blasphemy application against the BBC. I don't want to go into all the details of the legal front, but the BBC used taxpayers' money to put on Jerry Springer the opera, and they then used taxpayers' money to defend Jerry Springer the opera in our courts, and the BBC won, and freedom of expression prevailed for the BBC. And then one of the parties defending the production of the show went after this maverick preacher seeking costs and would have bankrupted him, because we have cost rules in the United Kingdom. So the BBC defended to the end the right to put on the Jerry Springer show. About 18 months later, on one of our political discussion shows, we had Charles Moore, the editor of former editor of the Sunday Telegraph and Telegraph, and there was a question asked in relation to the war and various matters in Iraq, and he said that the Muslim Council of Britain appeared to be reluctant to condemn the killing of British soldiers, and in fact gave the impression they supported the killing of British soldiers, and indeed the Muslim Council of Britain has a number of extremist links. The Muslim Council of Britain threatened to sue the BBC. It was a libelous action. How dare they record this, even though this had been cleared by BBC lawyers to go out, and without even talking to Mr. Moore, offered a full apology to the Muslim Council of Britain and £30,000 of taxpayers' money to the Islamic community. Now, that was a juxtaposed position. One case, the BBC fight for freedom of expression, and would take all actions to defend it. In another example, they give an apology and immediately pay monies or taxpayers' money to it. If I had challenged any of those, if someone had come to me and said, I want to challenge it, well, the minister lost the case of establishing blasphemy. He lost it. If you'd challenged the payment of an apology and said, well, there's a contrast between the two, no British judge would have entertained that. They said, it's not me to review the policies in contrast. My decision is, could a reasonable public body have made a payment of that sort and given an apology in the circumstances of the case? And again, that would have been, in my view, unproductive as a legal strategy. But it's a discretion used by a public body. That's what I'm focusing on in a minute. It's a discretion by a public body. The next example number two, taking Bruce's, is a young man called Umar Farouk, and you may know him as the Detroit Underpants bomber. He turned up in London as a pious but rather innocent Nigerian student, and rapidly became head of the Islamic societies at London University, where he underwent rapid Islamification, radicalization. And London is now a center of rapid Islamification, radical Islam. And he is actually now the fourth Islamic head of a student union to be in prison for terrorist incidences in the last 3 years. From Britain. Now, London University immediately did a report on this. They, of course, have denied that he was radicalized during his stay in London, and they've gone further that there's nothing they could really do to prevent his radicalization because our free speech principles would not permit any delimitation on speech and access to speakers and so forth. But you can rest assured that the university authorities, acting through their student unions, have taken firm and radical action against very dangerous religious groups. I've acted for a number of Christian unions expelled from universities by their student unions because they believe in very wicked things, like you have to be a Christian to be a member of the Christian Union and you have to love your neighbour. That's my very bad attempt at a joke, and the fact that nobody is laughing shows that no one got the joke. But the point I was making was that while this Islamic radicalization is taking place in our campuses, I have done cases where student unions have been expelled because by insisting that you're a Christian, for joining the Christian Union, you are discriminating against non-Christians. I remember when I did that case for Exeter University and I spoke to some American attorneys. They told me that would never happen in America. Your First Amendment would never permit that. Oh yeah, Martinez? Forum analysis, that's the way around it. So, part of my thing is, I want to come to that, why I think it's, I don't think America can do it alone. Whether you can be a beacon of light, I don't know, but I don't know whether you can be a beacon of light in a totally dark world. The third example is a case I was instructed in. I was instructed in a case where a church was closed for singing hymns on a Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. Yeah, you got it. Their noise abatement notice was served on this church, which is what we call a noise pollution notice, normally used for some factory producing something at 3 a.m. in the morning near a residential area, was used against a church for singing hymns on a Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. When the notice was served on the church, the local authority officer said, this is a Muslim borough. And by course, by implication, singing of hymns offended Muslims, even though the church had been there 150 years. Now, just two very brief points. The first thing is the local authority didn't deny they said that because the church told me they said that. And when it first was in court, the Muslim there were two Muslims and a Muslim majority judge, and they upheld the decision, and it was reversed on appeal when it went out of district. But one of the things that really played into the psychology of the church is, I quite often say when I have a client, if you're going to take on the radical Islamists, you've got to get publicity. In fact, the more publicity you get, the safer you are. And people are very, very fearful. And I have a lot of experience in this. I can go into it. They're very fearful. But this church lost their nerve. And they didn't want the publicity because they were scared of adverse attacks, and the minister was scared. And I believe that's why they lost it at first instance, was a Muslim majority court. And I believe that's why certain issues were not raised. And in fact, they were more endangered because they'd actually fought the case and were unknown. Example number four, you've probably heard of this one, Ben and Sharon Vogelzak, bed and breakfast owners, B&B up in Liverpool, bed and breakfast up in Liverpool, had a private conversation with a Muslim lady in their church in which they described Muhammad as a warlord. That was the phrase they used. The evidence was generally thrown out by the woman. She was deemed to be exaggerated, and she said the conversation took an hour, but it was accepted it took 7 minutes. And in fact, a Muslim doctor who overheard the conversation gave evidence on behalf of the owners. They were acquitted. I just want to focus on that. They were acquitted. But they were harangued in the press, and they lost their livelihood because they had 80% of their clients were from the state, and the state cut off using the bed and breakfast as a resource, and they have been in very serious economic financial difficulty since then. I'm going to come back to some points I'm making. Example number five was two street preachers in Birmingham, Arthur Cunningham and Joseph Abraham, who went into a Muslim area to seek Muslim converts for Christ. They were approached by a police officer, and the police officer said, "This is a Muslim area. It would be very dangerous." The police officer was himself Muslim, and told the individuals to leave. There was a conversation about the Bible. He would not permit any criticism of the Quran, but wanted to attack the Bible, warned that the passers would be beaten up, and they were removed from the area, although the police later backed down. Now, I'll just draw a couple of points on this. First point is, it was technically the street preacher's one. I'm going to come back to that in a minute. Secondly, the police officer was Muslim, as the judges were in my church case at the initial first instance trial. And because of the policy of social cohesion, members of the ethnic minorities are put into positions of authority and are implementing British laws, but they're not doing it, if I can be opposed without being accused of racism, in a particularly British manner, as we would understand those laws should be implemented. And then my final example was, it was a Channel 4 documentary called Undercover Mosque. And Channel 4 is one of our major TV corporations. They spent an hour, it probably was an hour actually on Channel 4, they're on cutbacks like everybody else's, but they spent a year investigating radical mosques in the United Kingdom. And of course, they came up with such delightful phrases were reported on television. "You have to bomb the Indian businesses, and as for the Jews, you kill them physically." And there's various phrases of that nature used in the mosques, advocating violent jihad, overthrow of the British state, war against non-Muslims. This was shown on British television. The dossier was given to the West Midlands Police. The West Midlands Police concluded there was no grounds through the Crown Prosecution Service for successfully prosecuting any of these millers. This is, talk about hate crimes and public order acts. There was no grounds at all for prosecuting them. However, they were deeply concerned that Channel 4 had breached the Public Order Act and had produced material for British television which would stir up hatred. And they referred that to the Crown Prosecution Service. The Crown Prosecution Service came back on that, saying there were insufficient charges to charge Channel 4, and they referred it to Ofcom, which is our regulator of the media, who said it was Channel 4, that the broadcaster had accurately represented the material it had gathered and dealt with the subject matter responsibly. Channel 4 went on to sue the police for £100,000 for libel, which is very unusual in Britain. You would call it qualified immunity in the States, but our police are very protected, much higher standards than American standards. And, of course, not everybody is the size of a major corporation. Now, the reason I've drawn these attentions of these examples, that's the environment I work in, where I could go on and about what happens and the realities of cases. I've done a number of cases in this area. But the first three examples were the decision of the BBC, was a decision of London University, and a decision of London University, and a decision by a local authority, that may not be a correct one, but where public bodies exercise their lawful discretion to promote diversity, tolerance, or whatever they thought would be in the interest of a more inclusive state. And those things are very difficult legally to challenge. And I would say there's nothing stopping American public bodies taking a similar approach within their lawful powers to adopt policies which they believe are lawful to promote groups and diversity. The other three cases, and you think it's bad in Britain, and yes, it is bad in Britain. I can make you weep if you want me to, but I don't have time for that. Were all successes. The Bed and Breakfast Owners won, the Street Preachers won, and Channel 4 got £100,000 off the police. The chilling effect of these cases, people's livelihoods ruined, people publicly arrested and humiliated. These incidents of the police using chilling effect, the fear factor of self-censorship, self-regulation, and one of the ironies of the current situation in Britain, because Islam is off bounds for criticism, a lot of the criticism is directed against Christianity, because people want to prove they're not cowed and feel they are able to speak out. Well, that's really all I wanted to say at this stage, and just give you these examples of the United Kingdom. Thank you.
Dr. Mark Gore.
Let me first express my appreciation to Nina and Paul for their book and their courage, really, in addressing such a critical issue for the security of the world, the freedom to be able to speak your mind about religious issues. And also my appreciation to the Federalist Society for the invitation to fly all the way across the Pacific and contribute to this gathering. In June 2009, President Obama, in his Cairo speech, reached out to the Muslim world and stated that he considered it part of his responsibility, I quote, as President of the United States to fight against negative stereotypes of Islam, wherever they may appear. And I emphasize the word Islam and not Muslim, so I'll come back to that towards the end of what I have to say. His speech was greeted, and this comment was greeted with great applause. And as we've been hearing, it's not a secret that Muslims are deeply concerned about criticism of the Islamic faith. And I'd like to, first of all, reflect why theologically this is an issue in Islam, why Muslims are particularly concerned about it. It's a long-standing problem. Omar Shay in The Marriage of Figaro had Figaro give the freedom of speech soliloquy in which he comments that if he criticized Muhammad in some way, there would be representations coming to him from all over the Muslim world. That's in 1778. But you can look back to the medieval Sharia textbooks, which describe, often in excruciating detail, many different ways in which someone might commit blasphemy. For example, the Shafi'i manual, The Reliance of the Traveller, explains that someone can be deemed an apostate for passing a sarcastic comment. For example, if someone says, "Trim your nails," it's recommended in Islam, and the person replies, "I wouldn't do it even if it were," that would be apostasy. And it lists 20 different acts that entail leaving Islam. For example, if someone says, "There's no power or strength saved through Allah," and then you respond, "Well, that won't save you from hunger," then that is apostasy. You thereby left Islam. Or if you imply that Allah's messenger or prophets are liars or deny their being sent, that would be apostasy. Or to say that things happen by their own nature and have cause and effect apart from the will of Allah, that too is apostasy. It's a great long list of the many different ways in which a Muslim can be deemed to have left Islam. And the list ends with the pious comment, "There are others, for the subject is nearly limitless. May Allah Most High save us and all Muslims from it." Sometimes blasphemy accusations can manifest remarkable creativity in extending these limitless scenarios, as a report from January in the Toronto Star showed. A Shiite Muslim doctor last month, when confronted in his Hyderabad office by a pharmaceutical salesman, told the supplier that he wasn't interested in buying anything. And the salesman persisted, according to the local reports. The doctor tossed the salesman's business card in a trash bin. But because the name of the salesman was Muhammad, the card having the name of Muhammad was thrown into the bin. So the salesman complained to the religious leaders that this was an act of blasphemy. The doctor was dragged out of his office, beaten up by the mob, and arrested by the police and charged with blasphemy. So these are one of part of the limitless scenarios in which someone can be considered to have apostatized from Islam. Now, there's a distinction in Islam between blasphemy committed by a Muslim or someone considered to have left Islam and blasphemy by a non-Muslim. In traditional Islamic jurisprudence, transgressions performed by Muslims are regarded as evidence of apostasy. That's the plight that the Baha'is and the Ahmadis are charged with. Now, not only does Islam prescribe the death penalty for apostasy according to the schools of jurisprudence, but also, according to Sharia law, and this is a crucial point, an apostate's life can freely be taken, by any Muslim or non-Muslim without fear of criminal conviction or the need to expiate for the killing. So, for example, according to the Reliance of the Traveller, killing an apostate without lawful authority at worst attracts a minor disciplinary action for arrogating the caliph's prerogative and encroaching upon his rights. This blanket license to kill renders critics of Islam exceedingly vulnerable in Sharia-compliant societies, whether or not there is a law against apostasy on the statute books. And it is the reason for the numerous cases of extrajudicial killings of people judged to be apostates, such as the shooting of the governor Salman Taseer in Punjab governor in January 2011. As an outspoken opponent of Pakistan's blasphemy laws, Taseer could have been judged an apostate for falling foul of item 14 in the Reliance of the Traveller's List, which states that to deny the obligatory character of something which by the consensus of Muslims is part of Islam, when it is well known as such, that is apostasy. So it would be considered by this killer to have been an apostate for denying the apostasy law. For non-Muslims, a transgression of blasphemy is not apostasy, but rather a breach of their pact of protection, the Dhimma Pact. The Reliance of the Traveller also explains that if the agreement of protection is violated, for example by mentioning something impermissible about Allah, the Prophet, or Islam, then the Caliph treats the non-Muslim as an object of war. Ultimately, the reasons for these strictures on blasphemy go back to incidents in the life story of Muhammad and in the foundation of the early Islamic community. Negative commentary was regarded and is often described by jurists as fitna, which is seduction or persecution of Muslims, which could lead them away from their faith. So to criticize Islam is to attack Muslims personally. As the life story of Muhammad forms a kind of theological bedrock of Islam, this theological principle gets promulgated throughout many of the schools of Islamic law. Now, I'd like to make a contrast between the Western tradition of blasphemy law. These blasphemy laws were introduced in the Code of Justinian on the basis that if people displeased or transgressed the rule of God, the nation might come under a natural disaster. For example, the Code of Justinian says, famine and earthquakes and pestilences are caused by such sins. But we've ordered the glorious prefect of this imperial city to arrest those who, after this our warning, persist in such unnatural impious acts and inflict the punishment of death upon them, lest by disregarding such sinners the city and the republic may be injured by reason of their impious acts. So the source of Western blasphemy laws originally was a desire to protect the state from the wrath of God. And as Western people began to disbelieve the wrath of God, so the blasphemy laws fell into disuse. However, the basis for blasphemy laws in Islam are completely different. The idea is rather that of the fear of fitna, that is, of circumstances that would lead Muslims to lose confidence in Islam. To address that possibility, legal authorities cite verses in the Quran, such as fitna is worse than slaughter, or fight them until there's no more fitna. In other words, the harsh penalties, up to and including death, are justified to suppress inducements for Muslims to be led away from Islam. Now, this connection between blasphemy law and fitna is made in the body set up by the Organization of the Islamic Conference, the International Fiqh Academy, which issued an important fatwa on freedom of expression in 2009. It recommends to the Islamic governments of the world to make use, I quote, of available means to prevent freedom of expression from being used to insult Islamic fundamentals and sanctities, or to sow fitna amongst Muslims, that is, to create the circumstances and conditions in which Muslims would be less than confident about their faith. Now, blasphemy laws have more or less subsided in the West, although there have been some recent attempts to revive them, but a new kind of anti-blasphemy legislation has been developed, and often under the guise of anti-incitement laws, and I'd like to speak about an example of that in Australia. In 2001, the state of Victoria passed the Racial and Religious Tolerance Act. It was modelled on anti-racism legislation from the 1970s. And the stated purpose of the 2001 Act was to promote harmony in an increasingly diverse society. The people of Victoria, it said, come from diverse ethnic and indigenous backgrounds and observe many different religious beliefs and practices. So the act was called a Racial Religions Tolerance Act, because its purpose was to encourage harmony. It was often associated with the term vilification, which is a somewhat confusing term, because in everyday English, vilification implies some kind of defamation. And we've heard the term defamation of religion being used in terms of these Islamic strictures on freedom of speech. In fact, the actual paragraphs of the Act don't use the concept of vilification, which implies defamation, which suggests untruthfulness, but they rather rely on the concept of incitement taken over from anti-racism legislation. For example, the Act says, a person must not, on the grounds of religious belief or activity of another person or class of persons, engage in conduct that incites hatred against, serious contempt for, or revulsion, or serious ridicule of that other person or class of persons. Now, anti-incitement laws, in essence, are designed to prevent or discourage the formation of negative stereotypes. This is quite a helpful thing in combating racism. And the critical issue with these laws is not whether the stereotyping is truth-based or not, but whether it causes a negative impact on the group's capacity to contribute and function normally within society. So one of the effects of anti-incitement laws is that they can censure truthful speech if that speech has a negative impact on the capacity of a group or class of people to participate freely in society. This causes lots of difficulties. For example, if you gave an accurate description of the facts of the Holocaust, that could quite reasonably incite revulsion, contempt and ridicule of the Nazis. That would be incitement. And it could be illegal to do that. And one of the reasons, then one of the effects of that possibility that incitement could be truth-based, like saying the French eat snails or something like that, is that one of the consequences of that is that anti-incitement laws generally have exceptions built into them, whereby you can, for the academic or artistic purposes or public commentary or public debate, you can incite, that is, say things that might cause people to have developed negative views, as long as you do it reasonably and in good faith for one of those purposes. Let me give an example of how this applied in Victoria, the Race and Religious Tolerance Act. It was passed in 2001 and it was applied almost immediately. In the aftermath of 9/11, a Christian revivalist group in Melbourne ran a seminar explaining jihad to their largely Christian audience. The speaker at that seminar was a Pakistani Nigerian Christian pastor who had actually been accused of blasphemy in Pakistan and managed to escape to Australia. And unknown to the organisers of that meeting, the Islamic Council of Victoria got wind of the event and sent in three converts to Islam to attend. They took notes and lodged a complaint with the Victorian Equal Opportunity Commission, and that complaint made its way to the Civil and Administrative Tribunal. Already before the case had come before the judge, some very important lines had been drawn in the sand. In the documents that the parties exchanged, the Christians asserted that they were criticising Islam and not Muslims, and they insisted on the right to make that distinction. The Muslims, for their part, insisted that it was impossible to make the distinction, for to criticise Islam was a personal issue for them, or as their barrister said later, if one vilifies Islam, one is by necessary consequence vilifying people who hold that religious belief. And this turned out to be one of the key issues in the case. Another problem or issue in the case is that many of the statements that were being complained about were accurate and true. For example, it was complained that Pastor Scott intimated that Muslims are killed by other Muslims if they leave the Islamic faith. And that does happen in some places in the world today. And it was complained that he said that Christians are persecuted in Islamic countries. That too was incitement against Muslims. And some of the other points that were incitement were accurate reports of what was contained in the Quran. For example, teaching that the Quran says that taking part in jihad in the heat of the desert is preferable to the heat of hell. Well, that is actually in the Quran, but it was incitement of ill feelings towards Muslims. The barristers for the Islamic Council emphasise, as for example Bryn Wojnarowski said, the mere fact that a statement may be true or an objectively justifiable expression of opinion does not prevent that statement from being seen as inciting hatred, contempt, ridicule or revulsion. Or as Senior Counsel Debbie Mortimer said, truth is not a defence. It's irrelevant to contravention of the Act. They'd originally scheduled this case to take a few days in the tribunal. In fact, it took many months. And the case under appeal went on for years. And there was quite a drama played out in the case. The Salafists turned up and they would just refuse to stand for the judge as he came in. They were very interested. He didn't compel them to stand or ask them to leave the court. I don't think he was... he had other things on his mind, you could say. And also the imams of Melbourne also made a submission to the judge offering to advise him at the last stages on what was the correct Islamic ruling for him to take. So lots of interesting things happened. In the end, Judge Higgins upheld the complaint. He found that the two pastors had incited hatred, contempt and ridicule for Muslims. He relied on findings about Islamic theology, and he appeared to uphold the claim that the violent verses in the Quran have no applicability past the 8th century, and that it was wrong in the incitement of Muslims to use these verses to characterise Islam or the behaviour of Muslims in any way. The pastors were ordered to cease from repeating their offending conduct anywhere in Australia. They were no longer allowed to express their views about Islam in public. They were ordered to take out prominent advertisements in Melbourne's daily papers reporting the findings against them at an estimated cost of over $50,000. And these advertisements were to include acknowledgement of the finding that they had broken the law. They appealed the case to the Victorian Supreme Court. When the judgment was, when the appeal was ultimately upheld, the case was referred back to the tribunal to be, for the same evidence to be judged upon by a different judge. As it happened, the two parties' energies were expended and they gave up. But the first judge's rulings, Judge Higgins' rulings, were criticised. He was found to have made more than a dozen errors of fact, imputing many statements to one of the pastors that he didn't actually make. But a key finding of the Supreme Court was that the judge, and this is my key point, relates back to President Obama's comment in Cairo, the judge had not adequately distinguished between the hatred of ideas and the hatred of people who hold those ideas, and the possibility of inciting one without inciting the other. Justice Nettle said in his judgment, I quote, "I do not overlook that Muslims are defined by their religious beliefs as persons who profess Islam, and therefore that to incite hatred and other relevant emotion towards the religious beliefs of a Muslim may result in hatred or other relevant emotion towards the Muslim. But it is surely not to be assumed that it must do so. There are any number of persons who may despise each other's faiths and yet bear each other no ill will. I dare say, for example, that there would be a large number of people who would despise Pastor Scott's," that was one of the respondents, "Pastor Scott's perception of Christianity, and yet not dream of hating him or being inclined to any of the other stipulated emotions. No doubt the purpose of the Act is to promote religious tolerance, but the Act cannot and does not purport to mandate religious tolerance. It is essential to keep the distinction between the hatred of beliefs and the hatred of their adherents steadily in view." So in this respect, the Supreme Court of Victoria rejected a key contention that had been part of the Muslims' case from the outset, that you cannot make a distinction between Islam and Muslims. Well, this was a very long and expensive process. The pastor's legal fees amounted up to the hundreds of thousands of dollars, while the Muslims were supported pro bono by one of Melbourne's leading firms. Tens of thousands signed petitions opposing the Act, and a spokesperson for the American Embassy in Canberra said that it was flooded with letters from concerned Americans. It was influential beyond Australia. Perhaps it also helped galvanise opposition to the UK's Racial and Religious Hatred Act of 2006, resulting in an amendment being imposed on the government by the House of Lords. Ended up being accepted in the Commons by just one vote. I'd like to make a few comments in concluding about the bigger picture issues here. To use the phrase of Justice Nettle, the idea of mandating tolerance for Islam, this is a value that's widely held by many Muslims. For example, Abu Ala al-Mawdudi, his widely referenced framework for human rights in Islam, Clause 9, speaks of the rights of citizens in Islamic State, which is the protection of religious sentiments. He said, "Along with the freedom of conviction and freedom of conscience, Islam guarantees the individual that his religious sentiments will be given due respect and that nothing will be said or done which may encroach upon his right. He's saying basically that Muslims have a right for their beliefs to be respected. It's a human right of Muslims that others must respect their beliefs, not them as persons, but what they believe. Islamization is a process of conforming a society's values to the requirements of the Sharia. And one of the things that was at stake really in the Melbourne case was whether Victorian or Australian society would accept the principle that Islamic belief must be respected, that there's mandating a tolerance of belief, not just of people. And Islamization can be both an intentional process. For example, the OIC is seeking to institute procedures whereby criticism of Islam will be made illegal across the whole world. It's a top-down process. And perhaps President Obama has offered assistance in this process by making that statement in Cairo in terms of Islamist demand, that is creating an Islamized sense of history. Well, the attempt to silence these two Australian pastors is hardly unique or exceptional. What is really excellent is that the Supreme Court of Victoria came out in favour of the principle that you can make a distinction between a person and their beliefs, that it was the heart of tolerance to allow someone to be very critical about belief without implying that they were thereby attacking a person. But others have suffered more intensely for their criticism of Islam. One can think about the murders of Pia van Kopp or Talman Tasir, who opposed the apostasy law in Pakistan. And there are many other silencing efforts within the law of secular nations, such as the United Kingdom's refusal to grant Geert Wilders a visa to the UK after pressure was exerted by Lord Ahmed. He threatened, I think, riots and demonstration in the streets if this was not implemented. And it's a very fascinating turn of events that it's a secular state rather than Muslims or their organisations which have been active in prosecuting people for speaking critically of Islam's laws. Many recent cases, for example, as Nina referred to, Elizabeth Savage-Wolf has been convicted, had a criminal conviction for the denigration of religious beliefs, as an example. Well, in Australia there has been, at least in the courts, a rejection of two principles which the local Muslim community in Melbourne had demanded be accepted. One is that Muslims have a right for their beliefs to be not just tolerated but given due respect, as Maudoudi put it, or to be have mandated tolerance, as Justice Nettle put it. The other is a rejection of the idea that it's not possible to distinguish Islam from Muslims, so that any challenge to Islamic doctrines is personal and an attack on all and any and every Muslim. These beliefs, grounded in sacred texts and shaped by 14 centuries of theological reflection and tradition, can be seen to arise quite naturally in parallel wherever more radically minded Muslims find themselves in the world today. But they are inconsistent with and challenge values of freedom of speech and conscience which have shaped Western societies. The case of the Islamic Council of Victoria versus Catch the Fire Ministries, Inc. was complex, long drawn out and convoluted. At its heart was a very simple principle of freedom of conscience and speech. That is, can you express a strong aversion to someone else's beliefs or ideas without being convicted of inciting hatred against that person? I'd like to return to Salman Rushdie, or come back to him. Nina Shea mentioned him at the beginning of the day. This is what he had to say after years of reflecting on his difficult living situation. He said, if an individual in a free society no longer has the right to say openly that he prefers one book to another, then that society no longer has the right to call itself free. Citizens have the right to complain about discrimination against themselves, but not about dissent, even strongly worded, impolite dissent from their thoughts. There cannot be fences erected around ideas, philosophies, attitudes, or beliefs. Whether the West adheres to its historic convictions will shape its future. At the present time, great alertness is required to the complex pressures being brought both from the ground up but also from the top down for societal transformation by the growing influence of radical Islam. It remains to be seen whether nations, their legislators and judiciaries will have the discernment and the wisdom to make good choices in the face of these pressures, and instead of sleepwalking into Sharia, whether they will deserve and indeed fight for the right to call themselves free.